This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. If you're a classical music fan, you may have noticed that it's very difficult to search for particular works of music on most streaming services. You can only search for artist, title of the song, and title of the album. But classical music fans need to search by composer, work, conductor, orchestra, period, and genre. Adagio has solved this problem for classical music fans. The Adagio streaming service has been designed specifically for the classical genre and makes it easy to compare multiple recordings and versions of the same works. So if you search for Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, for instance, you would be able to compare more than 150 recordings on one page and then filter them by conductor or orchestra. I especially like Adagio's curated playlists, which have enabled me to discover a lot of classical music I didn't know about before. Now you can try Adagio for free for 14 days and then pay just $9.99 per month when you subscribe. To try it out, visit podcast.idagio.com/renegade. Again, that's podcast.idagio.com/renegade. I recently conducted a special Ask Me Anything session for members of the Unregistered Underground, which is the supporting listeners group for this podcast. They are, I am pretty sure, the smartest fans in the podcast world. We talked about whether it's possible for feminism to be sex positive, the conservatism of identity politics, mass incarceration of and police brutality against white people, the teenage boys who refused to work in bomb factories during World War II, what to do if you ever get a welfare check, why socialists are just like libertarians, and we also talk with Josh Childress, who was persuaded to leave the Border Patrol after many years serving there by listening to Unregistered. Finally, we talked about the future, the possibilities for Renegade University, which right now seem limitless. To become a member of the Unregistered Underground so that you can participate in AMAs like this, go to unregisteredunderground.com. All right, here we are.
Thaddeus.
Hey.
Yeah, I want you to know what you did to me.
What did I do?
Okay. All the brainwashing, yeah, seduction even. Okay, so finally, I quit my shrink, okay? I'm no longer seeing my psychologist. So there, you saved me a lot of money already.
Good.
I can now spend that money on fine wine. Bon Romanesh, Bon Lucini, Cotroti, Corton Charlemagne, I'm buying it all.
Good man.
Yeah. Yeah, my anxiety is shrinking. My OCD is pretty much gone, okay? I no longer suffer from low self-esteem, okay? What else? Remember last time I spoke about suicide and all that? I no longer think about suicide. Yeah,
wow.
I no longer do. Yeah, you know why? You know why? This gift you gave me called postmodernism, I use that as a tool. Oh, yeah. Yeah. What can I say? Who knows? Maybe you even saved my life. And I'm thinking, what about thousands of others, you know, that might be feeling exactly the same? So you're not just some historian. You're not just some intellectual. You're not some just academic. You're more. No? Am I distinctive and unique in gaining this from you? There might be others. So I'm just saying. Yeah, there's this film, Ugetsu Monogatari, 1953, Kenji Mitsuguchi. And this scene, this guy is seduced by this geisha ghost. And after the seduction, he's in ecstasy and he's just rolling in the grass and he exclaims, he almost screams. He says, I never knew such pleasures existed. That's what he says. Yeah. So I'm saying, I feel almost like that guy, and you're my geisha. You're my geisha ghost who, you know, gave me this again. I found so much intellectual stimulation and freedom and beauty and pleasure in jazz and wine and literature. And now Thaddeus Russell and his podcast. Yeah. Your podcast is the extension, is the continuation. I no longer differentiate from, you know, sounds and of, you know, trumpets of Freddie Hubbard and saxophones of, you know, John Coltrane and Eric Dolphy and, you know, Keith Jarrett's piano and Thaddeus Russell, his mind, what he, your podcast. Yeah. I to me, it's now a coin toss up, you know, shall I listen to the podcast or shall I just open a bottle of, you know, fine Burgundy? I get exactly the same pleasure. And again, I find beauty, meaning, all of that. Yeah. So that's that. And okay, here's my question. Okay. So I was thinking about enemies. And I know you think you have enemies and you consider them, or people you dislike. Think about where Andrea Dworkin or, you know, Catherine McKinnon, Samantha Power. You like her? No, you don't. Oh, yeah. So no. What if Samantha Power comes to you and she says, but Thaddeus, what about my self-interest? What about, remember, politics of self-interest and freedom and pleasure and beauty? What if she says, what if in doing what I did with my career, my life, I found, again, intellectual stimulation, all of it, pleasure, beauty, all of it. What do you say to her?
Well, first of all, this episode was brought to you by Skirmantis. Yeah. Thank you for that fabulous advertisement.
Well, you gave me a lot. So
I want to know later, maybe further, why postmodernism allowed you freedom from your mental health issues, but
I'm coming to LA next year to be
oh, good.
So we can talk. Yeah, I'm awesome. Flying from London, 5,000 miles.
How's that? Oh my God, really?
Yeah, I'm in London. Yeah,
I'm honored. That's
I'm based
amazing.
In London.
That's yeah. amazing.
I booked my tickets, my hotel, VIP tickets. So Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I'll talk to you then.
That's tremendous honor. So Samantha Power. So when she comes to me and says, "What about my self-interest in saving the world's people from oppression?" I would say, great, go for it. You go get in a plane yourself with your own gun and go to Somalia and save people.
No, but everything she did, everything, do not exclude anything. She says, I'm sorry, everything I did. And even if she says, yeah, I know, I did all this, you know, bad, immoral shit. Sorry, Thad, this is where I found my, you know.
No, I
injected meaning into my life.
I would even do a GoFundMe to raise money for her guns. I mean, as long as, she, you know, so she and her friends, you know, John Kerry and Samantha Power and Susan Rice and all those humanitarian interventions, God bless them, please go to Africa. Those people need you, you know, and you fight, go ahead, kill whoever you want. You shoot whatever guns you want, whatever direction you want. God bless you. I'll even help you. I'll pay for your plane tickets too to get there. So just don't use my money. And don't do it in my name.
Well, yeah. there are a few efforts like to save, like when Nick Kristoff goes on a brothel raid, you know, maybe stay along with the local cops who do take, you know, other people's money. But like there are attempts to save sex workers from trafficking, whatever, you know, occasionally.
Yeah. I mean, again, sort of like, you know, there's no grounds on which I can oppose that. If it's purely private and individual and they're doing it on their own accord, if they're not using taxpayer money, our money, and they're not doing it in our name, let them do it. You know, I mean, they're going to wreak some havoc, but a hell of a lot less when they have the power of the United States government at their disposal. Yeah. So that's my, how's that good enough for you?
No, but I agree with you. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not crazy about those people either, but I'm saying, especially, you know,
well, no, I mean, I guess, so let me, all right. I want you to be satisfied and I want you leaving here unsatisfied. I would say to her, why is it incumbent on me as a U.S. taxpayer to fund your efforts, Samantha Power, to save the world's people? You need to explain this to her. You need to explain me. In other words, this is something you could say to all humanitarian interventionists. Why am I morally obligated to finance your mission, your crusade, is what I would say to them. And I'll bet you anything they would have no good answer to that because they're never asked that question.
What if she finds pleasure in torturing you.
Well, I'm sure she would. And then it just comes down to who has more guns. So, you know, but
that's her self-interest. This is how she finds beauty, let's say. And, you know, again, all that. What Angela Keaton found in stripping. What if somebody comes to Angela Keaton and moralizes her about stripping because Angela said that she found intellectual stimulation and pleasure and beauty, all that in stripping. So what if somebody like, you know, whoever, someone
of power. If someone says that to Angela Keaton, good luck to that person. I mean, I would say, you know,
maybe it's impossible to avoid these conflicts.
If you know? Value your testicles, I'd, you know, suggest that you not do that. I mean, you know.
What if every individual is a separate universe?
Huh? Well, I kind of think we might.
Own laws and laws of physics and all that.
I think we might be. I think we might be.
Yeah. Your son, Tobias, what if he says, I want to join the draft. I want to fight the enemy. What are you going to say?
He knows better than that.
No, but what if, as a hypothetical, what if? Imagine you have a son who says, Father, I found, again, beauty, pleasure, freedom, intellectual stimulation, all that in a battlefield.
So he and I actually had that conversation. We've had this conversation many times, but we had that specific conversation, I think, last week, just a few days ago. And I said to him this, and I'm very clear about this. I have no moral judgment about what he chooses to do with his own life, even if it includes joining the Navy SEALs, okay? This is all academic because he will never join the military, but this is just sort of my position that I've stated to him. You know, if he ever wants to join the military, which I don't think he will, but if he does, then I would strongly, strongly encourage him to join the Air Force or the Navy where no one ever gets killed.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I'm not going to stand in his way of doing anything with his own life because that's his own life.
Or Marines, because they're having so much fun, no?
Yeah, even the Marines, even Marines, even Delta Force, even the people who actually pull the triggers and kill people and get killed. No, even then, I would be beyond sad and despondent about it. But I wouldn't judge him for it because that's his own choice. Same way with actual Navy SEALs and actual members of the U.S. military who volunteered to do that. That's their choice. I just don't want them doing it with my money and in my name. That's all.
And do you think that they should face legal consequences if they do stuff that would be considered murder?
Nah, you got to keep that on policymakers. You got to keep blame, I think, on the policymakers. Generally, I've been talking about this a lot lately. Over the last few years, I've been moving myself away from condemning cops and soldiers and trying to avoid doing that, in fact, because I think that actually obscures the real issues and actually ends up letting them off the hook and, more importantly, letting the system off the hook. Mm. So I think every time we talk about racist ops or sadistic soldiers or something like that, we're actually doing the anti-war movement and the anti-cop movement a disservice. Because what we're doing is we're distracting ourselves from what the real issues are. Why people are actually getting shot usually has nothing to do with the personal character of individual soldiers and cops. It has much more to do with laws and policies, right? And structures. And so that's why this constant focus on the racism and the personal characteristics of the soldiers and the cops is not only a dead end, I think it makes things like mass incarceration, police brutality, and imperial conquest worse because we don't know what's actually going on.
Like the lawyer Vince Bugliosi is a famous lawyer who was not a political radical of any kind, but he wrote a book in the early 2000s saying that George W. Bush should be put on trial for murder for starting the war with Iraq, in which innocent people got killed.
I don't like that either. I don't like the world court. I don't like the use of international law. Basically, essentially, you're imposing a universal morality on the world through world law, through international courts, et cetera, the world court. I think also, again, does our critique of the Bush administration, do we want it to be that they were evil, that they were immoral, or that they made particular choices for particular reasons that were a disaster for us as human beings, us individually, not Iraq. And I'm not even talking about Iraqis and Afghanis. I'm talking about us.
Well, I think that was his point, that it was like he would put it on trial for putting American, you know, put on trial in American courts, you know, for putting American lives, you know, getting Americans killed. I don't think it was to save the Iraqis. It was like, you know, it would have been what would be murder in American court for Americans, you know, citizens. And like
the problem is that Bush was democratically elected, number one. And number two,
And number two, he essentially followed the law. So there's no, you know, it's, yes, I believe that ultimately it is the responsibility of Americans who vote. I ultimately think that is it, the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, the Vietnam War, you name it, the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, every single one of those actions was ultimately the responsibility, I believe, of American voters. Not Americans, but American voters. People who voted for those people who dropped those bombs and started those wars. So at the end of the day, yeah, it's on voters, not Americans. And, but again, getting out of, but I don't even want to moralize against American voters. I just want to say, look, this is what you voted for. Do you like it or not? Are you, because people don't even know what they vote for, right? So it's an educational project always we're undertaking here, is to let people know what they specifically voted for and the specific consequences of those things, and then show those things to them and say, do you want to vote for this again? For instance, this latest news story about how often Obama tear gassed migrants at the border. Has people seen this over the during the Obama administration? It was, he tear gassed, used tear gas. I think it was more than 20 times on average every single year of his administration on migrants at the border, exactly what Trump is doing as we speak, which everybody's freaking out about. Okay. So when I bring this up, when you bring this up to liberals and Democrats and even a lot of lefties, like hard left, it's not that they are in denial about what Obama did. They literally don't know that he did that. I've been criticizing Obama's immigration policies since day zero. I didn't know he used tear gas 26 times in the last year of his presidency. Liberals and leftists literally do not know what their policies do, what the consequences are of their own elected officials taking action. Right. And so that's why it's a constant educational process. And that's why I'm constantly doing what's called whataboutism. I'm sorry, it's not whataboutism. It's pointing out to people what the consequences of their actions as voters and political actors are, and pointing out that they're going to relive the worst of all of that if they begin in 2 or 4 or 8 years.
I'm at work now. I'm working. So thanks for interrupting my work ethic.
Tell your boss he's a great man and I love him.
Well, I love you.
Cool. Okay. All right.
I'll see you next year.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, AJ, did anybody write in their questions, or do we want to do that now, or do we want to?
Yeah, we have a few.
Okay.
In your recent podcast with Kathy Reisenwitz, the term sex positive feminism was spoken. I've listened to that section twice and I'm really having a hard time resolving the term. I need help unpacking it and deciding if this is a language I want to use. And if the person who asked that wants to jump in and elaborate, please do.
Am I the only female in this group?
Oh, God, no.
That's my question. I'm sex positive and I'm a feminist, but I've never considered using those terms together. And so, because I always considered sex positivity as being general neutral and not necessarily identifying with a feminist ideal. Yeah. So I guess my question is,
wow.
Yeah. Like, how do these ideal systems, how are they being woven together and why? What's the benefit in doing so? And how do they function as a unit?
God, I love this question. I love this question.
And I've never heard that those two being used together, you know, and it's like, especially this year, it's like I've attended a lot of discussions on feminism, and there's a lot of like progressive feminism in New York City that's linked to like the sex worker communities, the BDSM communities, the kink communities, the queer communities, you know, this whole like witch revival that's happening. Yep. And on all those discussions, like I have never heard sex positive feminist.
Okay.
So it's like, why is that even, help me unpack that a little.
Yeah. So let me give you a brief history of this, and then let me give you, I guess, what my thoughts are on it, which are still evolving. I'm still trying to figure this out myself, but I love this question because it sort of gets at kind of the core of what the things that I'm most interested in some ways. But sex positive feminism was a term that was coined in the either late 70s or early 80s during the big fight over pornography between feminists who claim that pornography was inherently oppressive and exploitative of women, and the hand,
which I disagree with.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know you do. And the fight was between them and other feminists, smaller in number, but who did not believe that. And those so-called sex positive feminists included people like Ellen Willis, who I always recommend everyone read. She was phenomenal. And others, I can give you a big list, but Ellen was definitely the best of them, I think. Then we have sex positive feminists today, like Kathy Reisenwitz and Angela Keaton and basic Laura Kipnis, and pretty much every sex positive feminist there is pretty much has been on my show.
So is it like a revival of this terminology and of this ideal? Did it get lost? Like what happened there?
So, right. Yeah. Okay. So the sex positive feminists, and again, this was a small handful of mostly women, probably 10 or 12 of them, basically fighting this fight with these anti-sex feminists in the 80s, 70s and 80s and 90s. They were also reacting against the long, long history of feminism going back to the 19th century, which has always been, and this is just true, and feminists need to confront this and accept it, but it's indisputable, has always been deeply puritanical, has been essentially anti-sex, has never once promoted women's sexuality in any way, except as a means for men to exploit them, right? So that's one of the things that Ellen Willis and sex positive feminists were really fighting against, not just the campaign against pornography, but that goes back, like, I'm not kidding you, like from the 1830s, the beginning of American feminism until today, that has been the dominant way of thinking about sex and women among so-called feminists, among people who use that word. Not all of them, but the vast majority, right? So yeah, you know, I use the term sex positive feminist to describe myself. I've used it to describe women who believe that their own sexuality is good and healthy and should be encouraged and all that, who think the pornography is just fine, et cetera. But you know, the more I think about it, the more I actually agree with you, which is that it doesn't make sense because the history of feminism, like 99% of it basically, has been essentially sex negative. Really. I mean, and you cannot find me a major or significant feminist text in England or the United States over the last 200 years, and I'm not exaggerating, that is not hostile to sex and sexuality in some way. You know, you can go all of them. Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique is just like a screed against sex and sexuality. All of the first wave feminists, the suffragists of the late 19th and early 20th century, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, all those people, they were like as puritanical as any Americans have ever been, which is saying something. So yeah, I think maybe we should dump the feminism word, maybe, if we're using sex positive, because those two don't go together historically. And I think that if you're sex positive, you probably don't want to associate yourself with the history of feminism. Now, what you could say is maybe there's hope for feminism, and that's why we should keep fighting this fight and keep talking this way, because maybe we'll change some minds among not just women and men who want to identify as feminists. Maybe we can rebrand it and change it, but it's what it would require. It would require feminism taking on a pretty fundamentally different meaning.
Well, I think that that's happening, and I think that, like, using those two terms and ideologies together is it's not conducive to, like, that progressive shift in feminism.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, so a lot of
I still don't want to lose, like, that ideal of being sex positive, but I think they're, like, totally they're autonomous.
Yeah. So the minimal definition of feminist is simply someone who believes in the legal equality of women and men, right? And so, like, I don't know anybody who doesn't agree with that. Right. I literally don't know a single person who thinks that's wrong, that the women should have different rights and privileges and benefits according to the law than men. So if we tack on, the question is, why have feminists been so hostile to sex? And that's a very long, long story, but it's important, which is that they have a point, which is historically women have been associated with the body and sexuality. And so they believe that to become full functioning first-class citizens and to be treated like men and to have access to all the things that men have and all the big jobs and all the power and all that they have to distance themselves from their historical association with their body, from their own bodies, from their own sexuality, right? To show that they are just as repressed, just as uptight, just as puritanical as all the presidents, all the scientists, all the generals, and all the rest of them have ever been. And look at Hillary Clinton. They've been pretty successful, right? They've actually produced many generations of women who wear business suits just like we do, who talk just like we do, who start wars just like we do, who put people in prison just like we do, who tear gas people at the borders just like we do, right? So, you know, congratulations, you did it. And that's what you get for it. So if you want a whole new, if you want feminism to be sex positive, it's a much bigger project. So we take on that much bigger project and try to convince a large number of feminists to be sex positive the way that you and I are. Or we can just give up on feminism and just start something new. And I have no position on that. I leave that up to you, Anna, and the rest of the people. Seriously. So yeah. It's a great question. I love the question. Yeah. Thank you. What else we got?
I think this one's appropriate. What do you think about the idea of cultural appropriation?
Oh, I'm all for it. Next.
How does its use as a terminology fit into the greater American socio-historical context?
Cultural appropriation?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the stupidest idea ever, pretty much. You know, it's right up there. It's top 10 stupidest ideas, I would say, because everything as we, I don't think, does anyone here need me to tell them about this? Because I'm sure everyone here agrees with me on this. It's every single thing we do is cultural appropriation. I'm speaking English, God damn it. Did I invent that language? Of course not, right? Did all of my ancestors speak English? No, they spoke fucking Gaelic and Welsh and Yiddish, you know? So we've been stealing stuff from the English forever and ever, but that's fine. It's ridiculous. I mean, come on.
Yiddish itself is a hybrid of Hebrew and German. It's like, you know, itself is like this thing that would not exist without cultural mixing. Do these people want to live with a world without Chinese food or Rhapsody and Blue or all these things that are just, you know, jazz? Right. Have you ever talked to someone who defended it in any sort of intelligent way?
No.
Like...
Yeah. No,
because like
no,
the few times I've heard, like, they talk about there being like this whole, you know, legacy of actual force, but you know it's like it's insult added to injury, but it's not the injury itself.
And, okay, so let me tell you the most intelligent take, I suppose, on cultural appropriation I've heard, which isn't terribly intelligent, but it's the best I've heard, which is this: that a lot of people who are ignorant of other people's cultures, which is most people, especially Americans, there's no doubt about that, in appropriating others' cultures, in donning the clothing, the garb, eating the food, speaking the language, whatever it is, of other people's cultures, they are so ignorant, they end up essentially mocking the other culture or patronizing to it, being condescending toward that culture, which I would say, in general, from what I've seen, is about right. Sure. But then here's the big question. So the fuck what? Right? So have you ever been made fun of? Has your culture ever been mocked? It's easy for a cis straight white man to say that because you have all the power in the world. It's like, okay, fine. But don't we actually have a choice though? We have a choice as to how we feel about what others think about us and the groups we belong to, don't we? We have a choice about how we feel about what one person thinks about us individually. It's not easy. It's not easy. But must we be damaged, injured, violated by other people's words and ideas? Not just about us individually, but about groups that we putatively belong to? Like something as ridiculous and nebulous as a race, right? That everyone who's intelligent and educated agrees is a social construct, a complete fiction invented to oppress people. But so we should now feel feel hurt if someone insults this made-up construct that was used to imprison us, right? That's what people are doing. That people are insisting on being wounded, insisting on being injured, insisting on needing reparations, insisting, and here's the thing, insisting that what is most important in their whole world, in the whole world generally, is what people like who look like me think about them. What is the most important thing in the whole wide world to them is what straight, white, privileged, powerful men think and do. Because according to that analysis, we are the only people with any agency. We are the only people who can make history, right? We determine what everyone else's life is. We're the ones who made slavery happen. We're the ones who disenfranchised women. We're the ones who exploited workers. We're the ones who are throwing tear gas at migrants at the border, right? We are always the ones who make history. No one else can make history. No one else has agency. Everyone else is powerless. We have all the power. So isn't it remarkable that identity politics at its core is fundamentally, mortally, lethally conservative. Conservative, because it tells everyone who doesn't have power, you'll never have power, ever. All you can do is hope that the man thinks differently about you. It's so absolutely conservative. A sociologist who was an indirect influence on me, I don't think I've ever mentioned his name. Joel probably knows this person though. Stanley Aronowitz.
I campaigned for him, 16 years ago.
I figured, yeah.
He really ran his green, and I was like, I barely knew what his actual ideas were, but like, you know, he's like a,
yeah.
You know, I like Stanley's the Greens. The Greens were still the centralists, you know, before the Green New Deal crap, you know, just completely took over the party. Like,
So a few things about Stanley. So the guy's name is Aronowitz, Aronowitz, Stanley. He's taught in sociology at CUNY, City University of New York, centuries. He was Ellen Willis's partner. This is one thing to know about him. The second thing to know about him, he was the mentor and advisor to Jonathan Cutler, who I've mentioned many times. He's the sociologist at Wesleyan, who was really influential to me. Jonathan and I sort of grew up together politically when we were in graduate school and developed a lot of the ideas I've been spewing at you guys. So Stanley's been has had some significant influence on my thinking. He also published my first book, as the paperback. So I have many Stanley Aronowitz connections. But he argued to a whole conference of socialist intellectuals, the Socialist Scholars Conference, which is the most ridiculous thing everybody's every single year. Can you imagine? Can you imagine an auditorium with 500 Marxists in it?
Well, I've been to Left Forum, which splintered off from it.
I saw Stanley Aronowitz stand in front of 500 Marxists in the 1980s or 90s and say to them, this identity politics stuff, which is derived from the Frankfurt School, not postmodernism, from Frankfurt School, he said, from Marcuse and Adorno and Horkheimer and those guys who said that capitalism is hegemonic and there's no escape from it and it has penetrated every inch, every fiber of your being through advertising and marketing. Capitalism controls our souls, psyches, and our personas. He said that idea, he said, is fundamentally conservative. When I heard that, the whole world turned upside down for me. And that was 20 or 30 years ago. And ever since then, I've been like, oh yeah, obviously. That whole way of thinking on the American left, which is basically how almost everyone on the American left thinks now, is more reactionary than anything Jeff Sessions or Orrin Hatch would ever think or say. Because if you say, and this is Ta-Nehisi Coates' argument too, right? White people have all the agency. Black people have never determined their own history. They've simply been the pawns and the victims of whites, right? So that means they don't get to determine their future either. So what could be more conservative than to tell people, especially the marginalized and the powerless, the people you care about, that there is nothing you can ever, ever do. And all that matters is what is in the head of Thad Russell and Joel Schlossberg and AJ Van Slyke. That's all that fucking matters to us. All that's important in the world. So who, I ask you, is the white supremacist? And who, I ask you, is the male supremacist? Them. Because they're making us be the center of the world. I don't want to be the center of the world. And I don't have to be. You can be the center of your world, even if you're born a slave. Even if you were born a woman in a 19th century farmhouse.
Oh, yeah. There was actually a post that is like one of the top posts on Reddit, you know, as we speak, is a slave that he was tried for treason. And he argued successfully that since he was a slave and not a citizen, he could not be tried for treason because he did not have the duties of a citizen.
Right. This is one of the many freedoms that slaves enjoyed that citizens did not. And this is true. They weren't drafted for the military. They weren't put in prison for the most. Very few, hardly any slaves were ever put in prison. Now, you could say they were slaves. This is true. But being in a prison in the 1830s or 1840s, that was being in a cave. That was being in a hole. That was definitely worse than being a slave. I'm sorry. Being shot through the head with one inch diameter lead musket ball in the Revolutionary War or the War of 1812 or the Civil War, yeah, that's worse to me than slavery. Yeah. Or having your entire arm explode, which is what happened, right? If you were just hit in the limb by one of those bullets, one of those musket shots during those wars, I mean, to lose a limb or an eye or your face, and to be drafted, to be forced to do that, to fight and die. No slave ever had to do that. Now, this is not to say anything about slavery. It's simply to say how horrible it was for ordinary Americans who were supposedly nominally free.
In one of your articles in Reason, I encountered a fact that there are now 500,000 white inmates in state or federal prisons. Incarceration rate for whites is 465 out of 100,000, higher than the rates of Russia, China, et cetera, et cetera. And he quotes you fully. He's trying to cite this in his article. We'd like to know what you have to say about it in relation to what you were just talking about, and was wondering if you arrived at how you got these numbers and these stats.
Right. So if you Google that number, you won't find it except in my article. Now, did I make the number up? No, but it's telling that I had to find it myself by doing math on my own, because that number is not obviously publicized. It's not spoken about. Because why? Because it doesn't fit the narrative. It doesn't fit the dominant narrative of criminal justice and police brutality and mass incarceration, which is that it's a huge racist project. So yes, we currently have, if you use the numbers, we have percentages of races in prison now. We know that. So if you simply use those percentages and apply those to the numbers of people in prisons now, not jails, not counting jails, this is state and federal prisons. If you use those percentages, and we have the numbers of the percentages, and we have the absolute numbers of individuals in those prisons, it's not that hard to figure it out, that there are roughly 500,000 white people as we speak in a prison in the United States, which that alone, if it were just white people, if we released every single black and brown person from prison immediately right now, the United States, and only had white people in prisons, the United States incarceration rate would be about fifth or sixth in the world. We would still be incarcerating more people per capita than Russia and Iran and China and all these other totalitarian regimes. So no one ever talks about that. We have, yes, blacks are disproportionately incarcerated. This is true, but it has always been the case that about 2 to 3 times as many white people in absolute terms are in prison than blacks. So if it's a huge racist conspiracy intended to break black bodies, kill black people, to reinstitute slavery, which is what people claim all the time, they've done a shitty job of it, because they've incarcerated and killed a whole lot of people who look just like me in doing that. During Jim Crow, not a single white person was accidentally segregated. During slavery, not a single white person was accidentally enslaved. But you know what I have been told by professors who spout this nonsense about criminal justice, about police being one big racist organization? They have said, all those whites, all those millions of whites who have been put in prison or killed by cops for drugs or petty crimes, nonviolent offenses, you know what that is? And they've used this term. I've heard this from more than one. I'm talking about professors, okay? It's collateral damage, they said. It's been collateral damage in the racist war against black people, which is, to them, is all that the war on drugs and war on crime have been. To which I say to them, man, that's a hell of a lot of collateral damage. You're killing more of your own soldiers than you are taking the lives the enemy. Imagine if we went to war in Vietnam, right? And there were 2 million Americans killed as opposed to 2 million Vietnamese killed. Imagine if we only killed 50,000 Vietnamese and 2 million Americans were killed, right? That's it's absurd, right? It's obviously a question of state power and controlling individuals who are anarchic and not following the law and not going to work regardless of color. And that's what the drug war was all about in the 1960s. It was about disciplining a nation that had just discovered cocaine and heroin and marijuana in a very big way, in large part facilitated by the opening of the borders in 1965, right? So you had the big opening of the borders in 1965. You have lots of immigrants coming in, and a lot of them, yes, it's true. Yes, it's true. A lot of them brought their weed and their hash and their coke and their heroin with them. Thank God. Thank God. And they sold it to us. They sold it. God bless every one of them. Right? Thank God. It's all true. Immigration and drugs have often been closely aligned for obvious reasons, right? We grow most of the drugs in other places. We need people to bring them in. So white people getting shot by the cops for no good reason, white people getting thrown in prison for nonviolent offenses. It happens not every day. It happens many times per day. many times per day. And it is reported in the news 0 times per day. 0 times per day. Can anyone name a white person shot by a cop? Can anyone here name a person shot by a cop ever in the United States? No. Even I have to think about it. No. Can you name a black person shot by a cop? Yeah, you can each name about 10 of them, right? Were each one of those 10 black people shot by a cop, was each one of those cases a fucking abomination? Hell yeah, right? Should the laws be radically changed in response to each one? Hell yeah, right? But the same is true of every single white person who's been killed or incarcerated for a cop for no good reason, right? But we don't care. And so guess what? We're going to continue to have 2.2 million people in prisons as long as we do this, as long as we make it into a race issue, which it's not. When we make it into the issue that it is, which is the state versus everyone else, right? Then we might actually reduce the numbers of people in prison. But until, so long as everyone's just talking about it's racism, 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 well, the only obvious answer then, if it's really just racism, is you convince all the police in America to be not racist anymore. And then they won't shoot black people anymore. I mean, that's it. That's the politics. It's the stupidest, most counterproductive thing ever. For a minute there, and this is Camille Foster has talked about this a lot, about four, like right after Ferguson in 2014, 2015, there were a lot of right-wingers, conservatives, Republicans. I mean, I'm talking about serious right-wingers who were pushing hard for criminal justice reform, who were pushing hard to get people out of prison. Then Black Lives Matter comes along and they start saying, it's all about race, it's all about race, it's all about race. And the Republicans and the right-wingers and the conservatives lost interest in joining with these people who clearly saw something very different and they weren't interested in act. I don't think they're interested in mass incarceration. I don't think Black Lives Matter is interested in mass incarceration. If they were interested in mass incarceration, they would be interested in the 500,000 people who are white, who are in prison, but they're not because they never mention them. They would be interested in the people who are killed every single day by cops, every single day, but they never mention them. There are 16-year-old, 17-year-old, 18-year-old boys and girls who look like my son who get killed by cops all the time or beaten up for no good reason. And every time I see some little story, I make sure to put it on Twitter or Facebook to publicize because no one else does. But it's happening all the time. Look at the numbers. And it's a goddamn outrage. It pisses me off because those people matter to me too, right? This issue matters to me a lot. And what's most important, and what's most depressing and tragic about it, although Camille's, I mean, he's fighting the good fight and he's finally, I think he's starting to turn the corner and getting people to like think about this differently, but it's a long fight. We're not fixing the problem at all. Like Trump, for God's sake, right? Just put forward this criminal justice reform bill that would have gotten people out of prison, and the Congressional Black Caucus and every progressive I've ever heard of opposed it. They opposed it. They opposed it. Cato was for it. Like all the criminal justice reform people were for this bill. It wasn't perfect, but it got people out of prison. And the Congressional Black Caucus and the left-wing Democrats opposed it because it came from Trump. So when you're dealing with this kind of an opposition that is so irrational, so hysterical, so paranoid, and so delusional, we just have to go our own way.
If I recall correctly, that when Jesse Jackson had the Rainbow Coalition campaign, his program actually explicitly called for increasing the criminal prosecution penalties for people involved in drug dealing that were higher level people. He's like that the low level dealers are disproportionately people of color, and that they're getting disproportionately put in prison. But like the people higher up who are planning the actual drug deals are much less disproportionately non-white, and he thought that they should actually crack down on that and be more forgiving of people lower down, which is the logical progression of the idea that it's racial disparities. It's like he explicitly said that there was like
But Jesse Jackson, along with almost all the Congressional Black Caucus and black ministers, black political leaders in the 70s and 80s, they were the leading voices behind the movement to lock up drug offenders. They were pushing harder than anybody to crack down, to have mandatory minimum sentences, to put all the drug dope peddlers in the prisons, because they were living in those neighborhoods. And they, not completely irrationally, saw the problem as the drug dealers. They didn't see it as a larger issue of policy and law, right, and prohibition. They saw it as this kid on the corner with a gun and a bag of heroin. So they insisted that they lock up all the drug dealers. And you can look at lots has been written about this. It was very much a black-led movement, mass incarceration. I'm sorry, a black political class-led movement in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Well, yeah. I mean, you see it like even like in the blaxploitation movies, there are a lot of them that are, you know, totally in like Coffee, Pam Grier is, you know, throwing off a drug dealer's head with a shotgun because she's like, they're coming into her neighborhood and are poisoning, you know, the people in her neighborhood. He's like, you know, get out of my hood.
So I'm putting, I think this is his name. I think this is right. This guy wrote a really good book, Michael Javon Fortner. I believe that's right. If someone can Google that and check it out for me. He wrote basically the book on this, and he pretty definitively shows, I mean, the evidence is just overwhelming, that all these black political leaders and organizations in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in Harlem and South Chicago, et cetera, were pushing hard to put people in prison, that they wanted all these black people in prison. So, Michael Javon Fortner, I forget the title of the book, but it's the only book he's written. It's very, very good, but it's very clear. So, criminal justice as an issue is just a hot mess in terms of conceptualization. People don't know what the hell's going on. And I blame the left. I blame the left for making everything about race. It's just not.
Is this the book that Black Silent Majority?
Yes.
The Rockefeller Drug Laws and the Politics of Punishment.
Yes. Excellent.
And the thing is, how did this change over so fast? Like, I remember during the Giuliani administration, how many New York liberals on every other issue just adore Giuliani for locking people up, you know, and getting rid of the criminals or like, you know.
Yeah.
Again, the same people are saying, you know, racism, racism, racism now, but like, you know, there are white liberals, but like they were like, you know, applauding, and also Bloomberg, you know, basically until de Blasio was like the only liberal New York mayor who is really city government level, who's been even making noises about doing anything differently. It's like, how did that switch over happen?
People forget, Joel, that's what history. People always forget the past. Yeah.
Have you ever thought about renegade histories of other countries or the world in general? I kind of think about Japan as kind of an interesting situation where they kind of have that really strong puritanical element. I wonder if that has anything to do with U.S. foreign policy and being there, and if there's any connection with that. And anyways, that's kind of just, what are your thoughts on that as a whole?
You know what, Landry? You know what? That's such a good topic that someone should write a book on that.
I'm writing about some of the stuff, but I think you're kind of bringing this whole field of history that needs to happen, and other people need to write about these things too. So
I've written 10 chapters of that book so far.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You keep saying you finished it, you know, just when everyone...
I know, Joel. And I'm working on the 11th chapter right now. It's coming. That's what I'm doing. I'm doing a renegade history. Now, I can't do a full history of every country in the world, right? But what I'm doing is I'm looking at the ways in which the United States interacted with other countries through that lens. And so what I do is I look at how American pop culture, right, came into other countries and how it then interacted with the regime there and with the people there. And so what I find over and over again, like a place like Japan, great example, mm-hmm. great question. In the 1910s and 20s and 30s, you know, the big thing was jazz. Two big things were jazz and Hollywood. Those are the two big exports of America. Those and cars. But in the 20s and 30s, it was mostly jazz and Hollywood. Enormously, enormously popular all over the world, especially in Japan. So Japan, by the 1930s, just before the war, there were literally hundreds of dance palaces and nightclubs that played American music and had American dancing going on every single night. The Japanese government by 1937, 38, just crushed it, just shut it all down because they saw correctly that it constituted an internal threat. What they said was, we will never have a disciplined nation ready to go to war with the imperialist oppressors so long as they're listening to Louis Armstrong and dancing and watching these stupid movies, which are made by the enemy, they said. Not stupid people. Now, the problem was they couldn't really keep that genie in the bottle, right? And so by the end of the war, by 1944, this is one of my favorite stories from the war that I just found out about, actually. You'll never see anybody talk about this. So Japan, by 1944, right, pretty much everybody's dead. pretty much like all the men in Japan are pretty much dead or they're about to be killed on an island somewhere. I mean, really, it was that bad, right? So they literally had no men to work in the arms factories in Japan to make the bombs and the tanks and all that stuff, right? And the bullets. Mm-hmm. So what did they do? Who were they left with? They had to conscript, they had to enslave teenage boys. Mm-hmm. Teenage boys were making, by 1944, 90% of all of Japan's armaments. Okay, mm-hmm. Now, so we're talking 14-year-old, 15-year-old, 16-year-old, 17-year-old, boys, teenage boys, right? Working in factories by force, right? They're forced to do this. Now, how might you imagine teenage boys to respond to a situation like that, especially one when their own fathers are dead and all the fathers are dead and there are no men around? How do you think those teenage boys would have responded? Do you think they would have gotten up at 7 a.m. every morning and like run to the arms factory and like happily turn to screw all day long making bombs? No. The Japanese government had to employ thousands of new police. They had to take some of them from the front lines in the war to simply police these kids chasing. They were chasing teenage boys around the streets of Tokyo, trying to force them into these factories. This is hilarious. I mean, sort of hilarious scene going on inside Japan in 1944. Those guys, most of them were boys. Guess what? They love to do more than make bombs. They love to go to the fucking movies. And which movies do they like to watch? Not the Japanese, nasty, nationalist, stupid wartime movies that talked about, you know, grain production in China. No, they loved watching Hollywood movies. They loved watching Abbott and Costello. They loved watching, you know, the detective movies and the gangster movies and all the rest of it. So yeah, I do that history in China, the same similar stuff happens, Philippines, all over the world. Yeah. So yes, great question. I'm working on it.
I think there's interesting, because like when you talk about in the renegade history of the United States and with the drunk Irish people and how that affected the weekend and how much we work, you know, in Japan, you still have people that are dying yearly because they're overworking themselves, you know, and this, you know, this whole repressed country and all these different things. Anyways, I think Japan is such an interesting example as a parallel to what we see in America and America's history also takes place in Japan in similar fashions.
So. Yeah. I mean, I don't pretend to know in any real way the internal dynamics of any other country. I'm just reporting what's been reported by those governments.
Yeah.
Right. So almost all of my research has been what governments in other countries have said about jazz and all, right. So they're the ones freaking out. They're the ones saying it's killing us. They're the ones saying it's destroying our civilization. So I'm mostly just reporting what they're saying, but yes, Japan, I mean, just a quick digression, I suppose, but like, I've always been fascinated from outside. I've never been there with what you're talking about, which is what seems to me to be like an especially pronounced conflict between repression and libidinal hedonism, I suppose. Right. So that there's all this obvious repression in that culture. But then also if you look at their pop culture, like the TV shows, right, it's like, it's more wild and like anarchic than anything in the United States. So, and then their pornography is like wilder and more insane than ours and all that. So it's a fascinating culture. I don't know. I really don't know enough about it to understand it, how it operates. Right. But I agree with you. It's something to look at.
I think I've been having conversations with a girl from Japan. I'm in college right now. So she's an exchange student anyways. And it's really fascinating kind of talking about these things and definitely just the weird where they have, like there's certain parts of Tokyo that are just very like brothels, shows, all this different stuff. But then on the surface level, no, but it's not a talk. Like when I talk about anything regarding my sexuality, she like, there's a weird gap between the two of us of how much we're willing to share, but we probably engage, if not more on their country's end, but the willing to talk about it in public conversation or, and you know, anyways, I think that's something that's fascinating.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's just, the problem is it's a really big world with a lot of countries to study, which is why it's taken me 7 years to write this damn book.
You know about the school refusing children in Japan? There are hundreds of thousands of kids who just refuse to go to school in Japan.
Cool. Good for them.
You know, that it has the most, you know, disciplined school system, and that the pundits are always saying we need to be more like, but there's just a massive amount of discontent of, you know, not necessarily people who find something, but like, you know, any sort of book about a somewhat different, you know, school becomes a huge seller, and you know.
Is it, I mean, it's a radically different culture. It's just really hard for me to understand it. I mean, because the basis of the culture is just fundamentally different. It's, you know, Confucianism, it's Eastern thinking, it's Eastern religions, it's Eastern philosophies. It's all have radically different takes on the world than the West and Western philosophy and the Enlightenment and all that, right? It's just very, very different. So it's hard. You got to approach it with great caution. Yeah. All right. Who else? Hey, I know that guy.
I've got a question for kind of personal gain, but idealism versus pragmatism. So this is something I'm kind of running into with what I'm trying to accomplish in the immigration field. Well, to bring it back to, you were talking about citizenship with you know, slaves not having citizenship. I hear a lot of people kind of open borders, pro-immigration people talking about like, oh, we got to get everybody citizenship. And I don't think that's necessarily one, what they want. Two, why do we want to sign more people up for the fucking draft next time it comes around? You know, like, is citizenship what we should be fighting for? So you suggested I check out Alex Nuestra.
Yeah.
And that guy's a rock star. He's brilliant. He does his homework, and he does come up with some really interesting policy. But in my mind, I'm like, no, blow the fucking thing up. Like, let's scrap this system and start anew. Like, so I guess my question is, at least your approach, do you shoot for pragmatism, which is in my case would be finding policy that would be realistic as kind of stepping stones, or just shoot for, hey, this is what I think is right and what I think is best, and it may be far-fetched, but this is what I'm running with?
Well, I think if you have a platform, there's no question what you should do in terms of effectiveness. So Josh, you now have a platform, right? When you speak, more than one person hears it now, right? So I think just this is just a practical question, right? What's more effective for you to do? For you to write another op-ed and give a talk at LibCon?
LibertyCon, yeah.
LibertyCon. Or to march at the border with a sign in your hand saying, let them in, or whatever it is, you know, whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any question that you are way, way, way more effective in advancing your own particular cause by speaking and writing than by marching. Now, I think that's even true if you have no platform. I think it's true. I think it's more powerful to change one person's mind than it is to march for your entire life. Right. Well, you're look who I'm talking to. Right. I mean, you're kind of like the poster child for this in a way. Right. I mean, you changed your mind from just listening to people. Right. And then you actually changed your life. And now you're talking and changing other people's minds too. So, I mean, you're kind of proof of this, I think. You know, it's political protest. I'm not saying it should never be done. I'm not saying it's worthless, but it's simply, I just think it's inescapable. The evidence is overwhelming that it's been, per capita, I think, way less effective than people just writing and speaking and talking, especially now that we all basically have a platform. Mm-hmm. You know, we can all get on Twitter, you know, even if we have one follower. I think it's better to send a one tweet out about something than to go march. I do. Just like, same with voting, right? I think it's way more important and powerful to speak than to vote. The other reason I strongly favor speaking and critiquing rather than participation, and you probably now know where I'm going with this, is this very important argument made by Arnold Hirschman many decades ago, social scientist, Voice and Exit. Between Voice and Exit, that was the title of his book, right? He said, everyone has a choice in any political regime. You can either choose to have a voice to participate, right? To be heard, to vote, right? Or to leave, go somewhere else, do your own thing. Either internally, you can have an internal exile, or like leave the whole place and go somewhere else and have your own nation or your own community, right? So marching tends to be on the voice side, you know, usually. It's usually not just obstructionist, usually not just oppositional. It's usually saying, let us in, let us in. Dave Chappelle has this funny as hell, and I think spot on bit from many, many years ago. I don't think he's done it in a long, long time, where he actually made fun of the civil rights movement. And he mocked the civil rights movement as basically a bunch of old black, and this is Dave Chappelle, a bunch of old black people marching around a hanging tree where they would hang people and saying, this is Dave Chappelle, we demand to be hung by the same tree. Was his joke. That's what civil rights, the civil rights movement was all about. And I think he's exactly right. So you get to vote, you get to drink from water, certain water fountains, and you get to go to the movie theater, and you don't have to sit in the balcony anymore. All things that I completely 100% endorse and I would want, and I understand. But guess what? You also get to go to Vietnam now, black people, which is exactly what happened to them. Beginning in 1965, in large numbers. Right after they got civil rights, they got sent to the jungles to fight and die against brown people. And they, ever since, they've been enjoying that privilege and luxury of being a full first-class American citizen ever since. So, yeah. I think protest tends to be about voice, and I'm much more interested in exit.
Okay, so since you've endorsed platform over marching... I swear this is not me. Somebody wrote this. How serious do you intend to get with Renegade University?
How serious?
Yeah, how serious? How big are you going to get it?
You answer that question. We're fucking taking over, man. We're taking over.
That was my question, and I'll expand on it just a little bit. And I don't mean just size, but... You know, I think it's great, you know, getting Scott Horton to make videos and, you know, that it's like level one pedagogy and whatnot, but you can do better. I mean, you could, if you wanted to, decide to have, a really sophisticated online university where people are doing collaborative problem solving and real authentic real world stuff. That would be really cool. And I know a lot about the CERTA, which is why you feel need to start your own. And I just want to hear you like, see how far you feel like taking it.
Oh man, I love that. The answer to everything you said is yes. Like, yes, yes, yes. I want to do everything. I mean, there's nothing that I don't want to do except replicate the stupidity and errors of other universities, you know? But I'd never thought about that, but like online collaboration where we're doing research projects remotely like this, you know? Oh God, yeah. One of the first things along those lines we are very much going to do is we're going to have our own basically research institute. So we're going to commission people to do research projects, to do writing. We're going to publish it ourselves. We're going to try to get them published elsewhere as well. We're going to have our own essentially academic journal, but it won't be peer reviewed. It'll be market reviewed, God forbid, right? But we are interested in all possibilities. We are going to start hiring directly from the American Sociological Association and the American Historical Association and the American Political Science Association. Each one of those has its own job board. Each one of those has hundreds and hundreds of unemployed Stanford and Harvard PhDs desperate for work, and I cannot wait to recruit them.
As a further thing, too, just before I have been on this Ask Me Anything, I was in another Zoom classroom actually being a guest lecturer at a Harvard class. And it looked exactly like this, except for one difference. The only person doing the talking at the Harvard class was me. Hmm. You're doing most of the talking now, but it has a more participatory feel to it. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm sort of saying that the overall direction of Renegade U wants to get away from a single expert broadcasting out to everybody. Nothing wrong with lots of experts and lots of expertise being broadcast, but as you know, tons of people have that expertise. The thing is to sort of get the ball rolling and provide an overall direction. So
yeah. All right, so I'll give you guys a free preview of Renegade University 2.0 because of where this is going. So we're about to unveil 2.0, the whole new website, new URL, new membership options, new everything. So here's how it's going to work. You can get a course a la carte, meaning like anybody can come in off the street and buy a course, watch it, that's fine, or listen to it, and you're done. Or you can become a member of the university, and then there's various tiers and levels, monthly payments or annual payments, right? And the way it's going to work is there will be just a lecture course where it's just some person talking to you on a video that you can download and play anytime you want, okay? But then there will also be the option for so-called students or members to take a seminar just like this with that professor, with that instructor at a later date on that topic, okay? So that'll be part of the deal. Then also people will have the option of doing one-on-ones with the instructors and professors, including me. And then we also have the in-person events, which we've been doing all along, weekends, and we're going to expand that and do more different cities all over. So yeah, I mean, you kind of, I think when I was teaching in universities, you know, for 20 years, my position on this was, generally speaking, discussions are better, generally speaking, but lectures are also useful, right? And so I love hearing a good lecture. I also sometimes need to be able to process the ideas that I'm getting from lectures with other people, in particular the lecturer and other students. So kind of giving people both opportunities. At Columbia, where I used to teach, and this is true for all the big schools, I'm sure you know this, you know, the big R1 universities, the standard mode for undergraduates is you get to talk to one person who's a TA grad student. You don't really get to talk to the professors, right? You get the discussion sections, but it's usually with a grad student. So we're giving people the option to do all of the above, you know, as often as they want to, too. I mean, there's really no limits on this. If you want to talk to me, you know, you can do it pretty much anytime you want. I mean, it's a question of what membership level you have, but it's a hell of a lot cheaper than a Harvard tuition, I can say that. Here's what the new front page is going to look like. And you can see that the four components of RU right there, video mm-hmm. courses,
nice.
Seminars, in-person courses, and the individual sessions. Those are the four pillars of our curriculum, Tom. Yeah.
And in theory, an in-person course, an instructor could be problem-based in their orientation if they wanted to, and that kind of a thing. It wouldn't.
Oh yeah.
It could go beyond lectures and discussions as well.
Oh yeah. I mean, it could be individual counseling. Right. I mean, it could be yeah. individual life skills. It could be therapy for God. I don't care. I mean, whatever you want to talk to Tom Nickel about, you can, right. You know, whatever you want to talk to me about, you can, for just a fraction of the price of regular tuition. You get one-on-one, or you get small group, or you get to listen to lectures. Right. So yeah. But beyond that, I love your thinking, you know, thinking bigger and outside the box. And yeah, I'm open to everything. I love the idea of doing, I want to do research. I want to have like our own research hub where we're producing original work and publishing it ourselves, right? Yeah, I'm all about it.
The infrastructure being independent is tough. I mean, I had a career at a university and then I could, you know, lean on them to do stuff. I've developed some of my own online courses now, but I'm afraid if 10,000 people start pounding on the little server I run, I'm not going to be able to afford it, you know? So there's really practical matters of doing an online course that goes too well if you're just an individual. But if you're actually creating a community and there's scale to it and there can be infrastructure, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is. So if you get 10,000 students, Tom, you will have no problems at all with money. you will make a lot of money. So, and you can buy your own servers. But yes, we will have the infrastructure for anybody like you, any instructor who wants to just talk, just teach, just do ideas, just do their thing and not worry about any of the bullshit infrastructure stuff. So yeah, that worked.
I was giving my course away for free and I did get 10,000, and that's why I've stopped promoting it. I can't support it on my own anymore. But
well, let's talk. Let's talk.
Okay.
Let me know if you want.
I think your Renegade U is just, I think you're doing a lot of good things. I think that's good. Just keep growing and growing, and we can't even imagine where it could be 5 years from now.
That's exactly what we think. We don't know. We just know that there is no roof. We have no competitors. See, this is the thing, guys. Right now, as of right now, I mean, there are no real competitors to this. There's no one doing exactly this. So there is no limit to how.
Well, do you know about the MOOC guys?
Yeah, MOOC, we're not. This is not MOOCs. This is
good. That's what I want to say. But you need to distinguish yourself from that. They'll say, "Oh, here's another guy trying to do a MOOC."
Yep. Nope. Mm-mm. I mean, we'll have a MOOC component, but that's like one little part of it. Yeah. Right.
Well said. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's good, man. Thank you very much for that. Yeah. I look forward to talking to you more. What do you teach? What's your field?
Well, right now I'm working in VR, and I'm working in VR spaces as collaborative spaces for online learning. The actual online course that has attracted a lot of people that I do has to do with preparing for end of life.
Wow.
It's called an instructional design for dying.
Whoa. Tom, we're going to talk later.
Okay.
We're definitely going to talk later. Yeah. Okay, cool. No, that's amazing. I love that. All right. I definitely want to hear about that. Okay.
I was kind of based off of that discussion. I was just wondering a little bit more on Renegade University. How much is there in terms of building out kind of, I don't want to use the word curriculums, but, you know, to have a progression so you can get kind of a deep concentrated knowledge instead of a scattered surface level knowledge. Because I find a lot of any subject I want, if I go on YouTube or something, I can get a very good surface level introductory, it's not even surface, just introductory level understanding of it. But if you want to dive deeper and understand some of the more advanced topics in a subject, I mean, to me, that's what I think is lacking. As someone, and I've done online courses, and they're all like freshman level. Every online class I've ever done is a freshman level course. Nothing that goes beyond that. And
oh, really?
Really right.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. Again, the answer is yes, 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 yes. So my favorite kind of course, both when I was a student, an undergraduate, and as a faculty member, was a course, an entire semester or even an entire year on one single text. I first discovered that at the London School of Economics, where I did my junior year in college. And they had these courses where they were year-long courses where they would just do Plato's Republic. That's it. An entire year on one damn book. And people were like, that's crazy. And I was like, no, that's the only way to go. I take that back. It's not the only way to go. What I think is both are great. So, you know, a survey of the history of Western philosophy is phenomenal. And I love teaching that. And I've taught that a lot. I also love dearly teaching the Republic, you know, or teaching Genealogy of Morals by Nietzsche, or teaching any single text, or even teaching a single essay, or spending days or weeks on an essay. Or, you know, I think that is really when you get into serious, serious intellectual work and you start to discover new things. And it's really, I agree with you, Liam, very much. But we're going to just do both. So I've already been talking to people. In fact, is John here? I don't know if he's here, but he's interested in teaching a course on Homer, the Odyssey. Yes, I believe. Yeah, it's the Odyssey I think he wants to teach. So an entire course on one text, right? But that courses like that we certainly want to do.
Awesome.
Khan Academy is great at that first level stuff. And I should applaud that. But not too many people are taking it
high school level. It's like, I've learned everything already. Like, I mean, that's not actually true, but a lot of it, it's super basic.
So, at Renegade University, what I want people to have is, and they already kind of do, even with the six or seven courses we have, we already kind of do offer this. You have both the broad surveys, right? And then you have, at least in courses, there are certainly moments where we do a deep dive into something, but going forward, I mean, there will be entire courses devoted to a single text, and there will be entire courses devoted like to the history of the United States, right? So yeah, either one, both. We got to do both, and we will do both.
Awesome. Cool. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah, I love it. All right.
Especially as a college dropout. So
yeah, our favorite kind. We love you. Who else has got a question? Come on.
Can I?
Please.
Step in?
Yes.
So I've got one sort of half-formed question about postmodernism, which I don't think I'm ready to ask yet. It'll just sound fucking stupid.
Okay.
Maybe sometime in the future. But I was wondering if you were giving life advice.
I try.
Well, yeah. Because I have a sort of a more personal question.
Yeah, please.
Oh, well, All right. Yeah. Clean your room, bucko.
Yeah, you're on the wrong show that someone else says that. But anyway, yeah. I don't care what your room looks like.
Nice. Thanks. So, yeah, I am a math student at a tech school. Hmm. And I've got 1 month left before I graduate. And it's sort of a deal because I'm 27. I dropped out and came back in, and my plan has been to go into tech, like a big tech company, like mm-hmm. Google or some shit. And lately I've been really disillusioned with tech. And I found your argument in your debate with Popat very mm-hmm. persuasive. And you know, this Amazon HQ2 shit, you know, I'm not a fan of that either. Mm-hmm. These large tech companies, and just sort of, I guess, the ethos, I guess, of the tech industry in general is just, I'm not liking it. I'm feeling worse and worse about it as time goes on. And so what the fuck do I do?
Well, what do you not like about it?
I'm going to get stage fright. I don't know. I like one of my teachers, works at Facebook mm-hmm. and I look at him and think like, what the fuck is going on in your head? How do you justify working at Facebook, you know, especially recently?
Yeah.
And I don't know, just this like this cultish attitude about what progress should look like, which often ends up meaning, you know, like gentrification and shit. Again, with like the whole HQ2 mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. These people seem political in all the right ways in terms of like inclusivity and diversity and shit like that, which is totally easy for them to be into because mm-hmm. that doesn't touch all of the really fucked up economic shit. And of course, you know, there's surveillance economy, mm-hmm. the fucking, all of our eyes generating money for them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. So it's all just really fucked up. And I'm wondering, you know, is my conscience like heavier than the, I don't know, 100K salary I might get, you know, given the fact that, you know, in this job market, I feel like it would also be stupid not to take that 100K salary. So, mm-hmm. so yeah, I don't know what to do.
Okay. Here's what you're going to do.
Please.
Please no, tell know. Me. I don't know. But I can say this though. I mean, what you're talking about, I believe, is about a half a dozen companies, right? You're talking about what's known as big tech, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe a dozen, something like that, right? The big giant monopolistic companies that we all know about that are super famous, that suck and are killing us. You don't have to work for them to be in tech, right? I mean, if you go to San Francisco, you will see office buildings full of startups, right? It's not, most of the office buildings in downtown San Francisco have like not one or two or three companies. They have like 100 companies in them. Each one has its own room or its own, I've been in them, right? And they're just startups after startups, and there's of varying sizes and ambitions and scope and whatever, right? There are people who have companies that just they're developing one little app that does one little thing and they make a middle class salary from that and that's that. And then there's people with bigger ambitions and all the way up to being a Facebook Goliath, right? So I would say for you, first of all, and this is what I say to everybody, is just like decide what you want. Like I have no idea what you want, but what do you want? Do you want to be Zuckerberg? Do you want to be a huge global giant with power over people's lives around the world? Then you should probably work for Facebook. If you want to make something that you think is cool and interesting and useful for you and other people and you can make some money on it, then you should do that, right? You don't have to go work for big tech, do you? I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert on that world, but I do know that that's only a small percentage of the tech world is those people, right?
That is true. I'm not sure why I default to those, actually.
I personally know, first of all, we're a tech startup right here. This is what this is, right? I personally know probably half a dozen people, something like that, who are doing tech startups. Like, they have nothing to do with Facebook and they have no interest in being like that. And their ambitions, it's about your ambition, right? That's it. It's about the scope of your ambition. How big and powerful and important do you want to be? Like, do you want to invent things that change people's lives? Do you want to be the next Steve Jobs? Or do you want to be like Steve Jobs, but, you know, you will invent not quite the iPhone, but something that'll be useful for people? Or, you know what I mean? Like, that should direct your decision-making as to go forward. Once you've decided what you want in life, Matthew, then it's just a question of strategy about how to get it.
Maybe to put some more flesh on those bones.
Okay.
In the short term, I want to make some money, I guess, and then, you know, maybe use that financial freedom to do something more interesting. But one of my longer term goals is I want fucking like nanotech, you know. I want like a post scarcity technology. That, you know, anyone could, you know, it's not something I would force on people. They could have it if they want to. And it would just sort of, you know, you could just like take dirt and then turn it into a house, like right in front of your eyes, you know, and like make the food that you want, you know, do all the, I don't know, ecosystem shit that you would want to do to make it sustainable. So that, like, because ultimately I think it's immoral that we have to work in order to keep living. And if we had that, you know, if it became like that cheap, just the cost of little nanomachines, which would be cheap. I mean, theoretically, ideally.
So let me tell you my feelings about that. Okay. So I don't think it's immoral that we have to work in order to live. I just think it sucks. Right. So I want to do less of it. And I want you to be as successful as possible, to take as much of my labor away as possible by inventing stuff. Right. And that's what you're talking about doing. Yeah. That's why I love technologies, because it can take away labor. Now, we can also be handed something that looks like this and then work, it turns out, a whole lot more. Right. This has more productive power than a fucking steel factory. Right. And it's in our pockets. Yet, what do? We use it not to work less. We use it, most of us, use it to work a whole lot more, don't we? So it's a cultural question. So you can invent all the nanotechnology that makes dirt into gourmet meals and houses and stuff. But if Americans think that work in itself is good, makes you a good person, they're going to use your nanotechnology to work more.
Well, fine, let them.
So that's why I do what I do, right? I try to just change people's minds, and I ask them the question that I asked you, which is, what do you want in life? And I don't know what that is, but people don't ask that of themselves. So a lot of Americans, just when they're asked that question, they say, oh, well, I want to do what's right, what's morally correct, rather than thinking about what they themselves want, what's going to benefit them, what's going to make them feel good.
Right. Well, ultimately, that is what I want. That's the life I would want to live.
Me too. Right. So you want a life without work.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to be free from work and maybe do it if I want to, but
yeah, who wouldn't? Right. Exactly. Well, here's who wouldn't. Americans love to work. Their identity is constituted around work. You may have noticed. Ask a European how they greet each other. It's not, what do you do? It's, who are you? We greet each other with, what do you do? Like, right after the name, it's like, oh, hi, Matthew, what do you do? Right? Your job, your occupation, your work is what is most, it's paramount, right? In your identity as an American. For Americans, that's what matters the most. So, like, I'm not Thad Russell, I'm a podcaster. Like, or a professor, or, right, you know what I mean? Like, it becomes, that's the next word after your name, is your profession. And that becomes your identity. It's a noun, right? It's a noun. So that's the deeper problem. You have you know, Steve Jobs, look, he made it a miracle for us. He eliminated God knows how many zillions of hours of work with this thing, but we stupid ass puritanical Americans use it to just work harder. Now we can work in the elevator on the way up to the office from the street. Now we can work in bed when we're sitting lying next to our wives. Right after we have sex, we can go right back to work because the phone is right there in our hand. We can be butt naked in bed with our girlfriend and still be working. And guess what? A lot of us have done that, haven't we? Haven't we? Yes, we all have. And it's, so it's our fault. It's a cultural question, right? So please, God, we need the technology, but we need different ways of thinking about technology too. Mm-hmm. But don't work for big tech. They suck. Go your own way.
All right. Cool. Cool. Thanks.
Thanks, man. That was great though. Thank you. Who? So bring it. Who's got questions?
I got another one.
Good.
In reference, well, I thought about this during your interview with Popat, and I left for a minute, so I don't know if somebody else already asked this, but what if you could benefit from subsidies? I know that you are a man of politics and self-interest.
Yeah.
Would you take them if you could?
Well, okay. So being completely amoral and cynical fucker, the answer is totally, but it all depends on the strings attached.
Right.
Right. So the only time I've ever been given, really welfare of any kind was when every American got welfare, which was during the George W. Bush administration. I forget which year, but it was like 03 or 04, somewhere around there. People remember this? He literally sent everyone a check.
Oh, yeah. Right?
And I got a check for like $300 and something in the mail. Like, it was just a check from the Treasury Department with my name on it. What did I do? You know what I got? Listen to me. Look, I'm a principled man. So you know what I did with that check? I held that check over my head. I took a picture of it. I put it on all social media. I said, I will not cash this check ever because this is blood money. No, fuck that. I put that right into my bank account and I spent it on beer immediately. And if Trump or Obama gave me a check, I would use it. Well, I'd use it for weed, but other than that, I would still use it. You're just a fool to turn it down. I don't think Mark Zuckerberg is like dumb for turning, like, of course he's going to take the subsidies. Of course he's going to take like free rent in downtown San Francisco, for God's sake. Like, you know, I mean, of course he's going to take the no payroll tax at all ever rule for him and him only. Of course. So yeah, I mean, that's, again, it's about the game and not the players, Josh, right? Same thing. It's like, well, you know, what's interesting about you is the border patrol, you may have noticed, has been in the news a lot lately. Since when you came out, like all these guys apparently in the border patrol turns out are rapists and murderers and like blowing shit up in the desert and starting forest fires too. Like, what the fuck is going on there? So but wait, hang on. So like the guy who, what was it, the serial rapist murderer or whatever, and then okay, so all the attention gets focused on that, right? This is the same thing with the cops and the soldiers. It's like all the attention on the evil Border Patrol agents, right? And I'm sure, well, I know that dude's evil. I'm sure many of them are, right? But what does that get us, right? What we need to do is just find good angelic human beings to be our cops and our soldiers and our Border Patrol agents, right? No.
It doesn't change policy.
You got to change the law, change the policy, and then you just hire people to implement the goddamn policy. So same question. Yeah. I mean, it's, so would I take subsidies? Totally. Am I opposed to subsidies? Totally. I hope that should make sense to you by now, right? Everyone should know.
Intuited that, but I wanted to see if you actually had a stance against it or. Well,
it's like socialists. It's like, you know, socialists have understood this question for a long time. It's like, do they buy and sell things in a capitalist market economy? Yes. Are they opposed to a capitalist market economy? Yes. Right. It's similar, right? I mean, right. Yeah. I drive on the state's roads, you know, I also am not sure the state should be making roads. I don't know. I mean, I'm just, it's an open question, you know, but I use the state's stuff. My son is in a fucking public school, which I hate with every fiber of my being, but I send him there because I have no choice because the state has a monopoly essentially where we are. So, yeah. All right, come on, bring it. Come on, somebody.
All right, I got one.
There we go.
Okay, so you put a lot of emphasis on postmodernism, right? And it seems to me like one of your main points is to give an anti-essentialist perspective. Mm-hmm. Why do you not then also talk about existentialism?
Because I don't know it very well. So I read Camus and Sartre in college, and I haven't touched it since.
Fair enough.
Can you tell me why I should?
Well, exactly that reason. It's very foundational for anti-essentialist argumentation.
Can you give that to me? And this is a completely serious question. Can you give that to me like in a short paragraph? Like give me the how I can sort of guess, but I want to hear someone else say it. Like what's
well, the okay. So Sartre defines existentialism as existence precedes essence, right? Mm-hmm. So that is what he really thinks is the foundation of the entire philosophy. And what that means is that first, you know, the world or the universe, whatever you want to call it, exists. And then there's essences that people create through meaning and all sorts of other mechanisms. But then even on top of that, there's the whole argument about authenticity and what that means within the philosophy of existentialism, which is that we are damned or doomed to be free, right? Mm-hmm. We always have the freedom to make a choice about how to interpret reality because of that anti-essentialist foundation.
Right.
So it would seem to jive with most of what you say.
Well, so as a practical matter, I think that I would probably operate in the world similarly to the existentialists, but there's a really deep difference between the two of us, which is that they seem to believe that there is this thing called existence, which is apart from and outside of human consciousness, which you can't think about differently. It's just a thing. Is this correct? That it is essential? There is something essential?
No. Okay. I mean, Sartre's main work is called Being and Nothingness. And the whole idea of that is that you can't really separate consciousness from what might be considered being, and what consciousness really is nothing, as in, I mean, it gets really philosophical, but it is not the in itself. Mm-hmm. It is a break with undifferentiated being or whatever.
Yeah.
It would take more than a paragraph to summarize that, but
yeah, I mean, Daniel Coffin says this really well, but I mean, for postmodernists of the Foucauldian Derrida variety of the 1970s French variety, it's not that they say that it's not so much that they say that there's no such thing as reality or truth or something outside of human consciousness. It's just that there is no meaningful difference or distinction between real and the discursive, between truth and language. It's all language to them, right? Everything is language. I'm going on your summary of Sartre and Camus, but like, or Sartre, I guess, it sounded like they draw some sort of distinction between this thing called existence and this thing called essentialism or essence. And I think for most postmodernists of the 70s generation, after post Sartre, right, that they would not like that. That they would just say it's simply all language. There is no two different things, two modes of existence, or whatever that is.
We should have a longer conversation about that, because it definitely they tie together very closely. Foucault especially was influenced by Nietzsche, and Heidegger has a huge influence on all those thinkers.
Oh, there's no doubt that they're part of the same lineage. Oh yeah, for sure. They're related. I just don't know if they're like first cousins or brothers. You know what I mean?
The main difference seems to be that the postmodernists have this idea of the subject that is more structural than the more. It's a response to what's his name? Levi Strauss and the structuralist thinkers. So it's not really that there's a lot of differences at the foundation. It's more timing and what was relevant.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Yeah, I mean, even the Frankfurt School, Connor Habib insists that the Frankfurt School is the transition from Marxism to postmodernism. And I think he's onto something. I don't think he's wrong about that, but there are some fundamental breaks between the postmodernism that I talk about and the entire Marxist tradition, including the Frankfurt School.
Absolutely.
I know you agree with that. For the existentialists, I just don't know enough to really speak about it intelligently, but I'll keep it in mind. I'll have to look into it later. I mean, yeah, I read all that stuff, but I told you it was like in the 19th century. So a long time ago, but thanks. I'll definitely keep that in mind. Something for me to know, important to know.
I think Will's got a question.
All right, Will, let's go. I got 15.
Hey there, minutes. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Hey, I'm interested in what you talk about and write about Puritanism. And I just had a question for you because I live abroad. I spent a lot of time abroad. And I was just thinking about my father-in-law, who's Chilean. He basically works all the time, runs a successful business. He lives in an average house, drives an average car, doesn't drink, doesn't smoke. You know, so I'm just curious, when you talk about Puritanism, what makes it uniquely American? And is this part of just kind of a greater, I guess, kind of part of subculture like worldwide, or how would you distinguish that?
Mm-hmm. Did you say it was your father-in-law?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you heard him speak about work in as a thing? Like, does he have ideas about work?
I've actually never met him, but that's a long story. That's a whole other story.
You've never met your father-in-law?
No.
Okay.
But yeah, it's basically from just what, you know, what my wife tells me about him growing up with him. And it sounds like it jives perfectly with what you talk about, you know, when you talk about the puritanical work ethic and kind of the puritanical personality.
Yep.
So that's why I'm curious, you know, and I live abroad, I spent a lot of time abroad, and you kind of see strains of that everywhere, right? These, and that sort of tension that you talk a lot about between kind of the renegade and the Puritans. And so I'm just wondering, like, what is it that really to you makes it uniquely American, or what differentiates it in the context of the United States?
It's kind of similar to Landry's question earlier about different countries going through the renegade civil wars. Where are you?
I'm in Australia.
Oh my God. Are you in a park?
No, I'm outside. I'm actually working in my garden.
He's in Australia. I can't get over this. Okay. He's outside in Australia. He's not even indoors in Australia. And he's talking to us. Okay. So here's the deal. Puritanism, the Puritan work ethic, is not about behavior. It's not about working really, really hard. It's not about having a really boring life. It's not about not drinking and never having sex and working all the time. You can do all those things and not be a Puritan.
Right.
Here's what being a Puritan is about: ideas, right? It's an ideology.
Right.
It's an ideology of work and sex and pleasure and fun, mm-hmm. right? So that's the thing. If your father-in-law, is he Australian or American?
No, he's Chilean.
Oh, he's Chilean. Okay.
Yeah.
So most people simply don't have this bizarre idea of work being good in itself.
Right.
Except Americans. As far as I know, I have never heard of another national culture outside of Scotland and England, where it was invented. I've never heard of another national culture that has that particular idea that work in itself is a good thing, no matter what you gain from it. So that's the Puritan and really American, because even the Brits and the Scots don't really believe that shit themselves anymore. It's really pretty much, as far as I know, only Americans. Maybe there's some Asian cultures that have that, but it would be different as well. But I've never heard of another culture that's really clear about that, where we constantly remind ourselves and each other that even if you're rich, you should work. Even if you don't need to work, you should work. The more you work, the better the person you are. If you don't work, you're a bad person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the current, for instance, panic of all the men in the United States not working, right? Which you've all heard of, right? That's why there's a panic. Like when I hear that, I'm like, wait a minute, men are not working. I'm like, wait, this is bad news or good news? I don't get it. Now, men not having money is bad news, right? And so I want always less work and more money. But if it's just that not working, and that's all that people seem to care about, right? Do you hear people talk about
the
crisis of men not having enough money? No, you hear about the crisis of men not working enough. That's the crisis, right? That everybody talks about. That's the problem, is that they're not working. They're sitting at home. They're watching, they're playing video games. They're watching television. They're watching YouTube videos. They're not working, right? That's the problem. Now you can see there are many, many different possible problems in that scenario with a guy who doesn't have a job. I can also see that being a very good thing, right? But what Americans only talk about is the fact that they're not working. Now, this is also highly gendered. If it were women, that would be a different story, right? We get hit, men get hit with a Puritan work ethic harder than anybody, but women get hit with it too. But that's the thing, right? We need to be working to be good, to be whole, to have an identity, to be taken seriously, to be respected, to respect ourselves, right? We hate ourselves when we don't make enough money as men in this culture. It's pretty, I mean, people talk about toxic masculinity. To me, that's what's toxic about masculinity. That actually feels like poison running through my bloodstream sometimes. Right? How bad that feels, right? And the pressure to be good in those ways. So does that answer your question? That's how it's distinctive from other work.
Yeah, no, and it's curious. And, you know, it's going to be different everywhere you go. But yeah, it is funny. You know, my wife who is Chilean, and, you know, when we lived briefly in the States and she worked in an office, commented on how bizarre it was that people would brag about how much they worked or how many hours they worked. And to her, it's like, that's the last thing you want to brag about the culture she's coming from. It's interesting to me. Yeah. Kind of traveling or living abroad, talking to other people and, you know, hearing the ways people, and it definitely is true. You do have traces of it here in Australia. Maybe it's because of the Anglo background, but you know, by 5 o'clock, everyone's at the pub, you know?
So Will, my whole thing, and it's just like so goddamn simple and obvious. I don't know why I even have to say this. You know, it's like, all I'm calling for is that we think about work as a means to an end.
Right.
That's it. Not an end in itself. Like, that's it. That's all I'm saying. But that is like a radical concept for Americans. They can't, whereas the rest of the world has no problem with that. But Americans, for whatever reason, I don't have the absolute explanation for that, except that we were founded by Puritans. But anyway, they can't let go of that idea. That's all you got to do. And then that doesn't mean you're not going to work again. That doesn't mean we're going to be poor. You're going to work just as much, but you're going to work with a purpose in mind rather than just working because God says so.
Yeah. Absolutely. I guess it's just people aren't aware of it so much. You know, it's so ingrained in our society and pounded into us from such a young age. You just think that's the way it is, I suppose.
Like sexual repression, right? We don't walk around thinking, oh, I shouldn't say the thing I just thought. We just don't say it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I shouldn't have these bad thoughts about sex, but we just have the thoughts and we don't speak, right? You're right. I agree. So we need to first start speaking those thoughts, number one, right?
Right.
And then we need to defend those thoughts.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's good. Yeah. Thanks, man. That's really good.
No problem.
Okay. I got time for one more question, so it better be good. No, I'm kidding.
Who wants it?
It doesn't have to be good.
I have a quick question, kind of more practical question.
Sure.
How do you go about your research, and is there anything as a historian that you can give? Because I have 8 books behind me for my own research. So what are some tips or strategies that you have about research and finding those kind of interesting anecdotes that you do in Renegade History?
So you go to the library and there are these cabinets that are the size of half a football field, and in them are thousands and thousands of 3x5 cards. Each card has all the information you need for the book, Landry, that you're looking for. So they want you to go to the library and then read through all those books until you find. So that's what I used to do in the 1990s. So it was much slower then. And this is important. I mean, it's really radically changed. This is why it's an interesting question. It's radically changed. I spent probably close to half of my life in the 1990s in a library because I had to. So microfilm. So all the newspapers and magazines were on microfilm, which took forever. All the books were in the libraries. They weren't on Google Books, right? There were no databases online with journal articles. I had to go look up the journal article in the library and pull it off the shelf and Xerox it and all that shit. Now I rarely need to leave my desk, and I think I found a number of phonograph records imported into Cairo in 1912 from my desk, you know, whereas before that would have probably required a trip to Cairo to find out. So I mean, honestly, Google, but you got to have a really intelligent, you have to have a scholar's and a researcher's mind using Google. So to say that it's not quite as simple as it sounds. Like, I have been doing this my entire life pretty much. So I'm just very fast about researching. I know what I always know what I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. So I used to tell my students this, my normie students, you know, what happens is, because they have the same question, like, how do I do the research for this thing? And it's like, it's really easy once you have the right question. Mm-hmm. It's all about the question. Okay, so if your question is, what's interesting in the world, then the library is just a mass of a million books and you got to read every single one of them, right? But if your question is, how many phonographs were imported into Cairo in 1912, almost all the books and articles and journals in the library just sort of disappear when you walk into it, and you pretty much just see the one book or the one volume you need to look at and go to, right? So all that time is eliminated when you have the right question. When you have the right question. And I always have the right question, so I know where to go. I mean, I do. I mean, it's just because each project begins with a question, right? So like, why do we have legal alcohol? Why is it okay for women wear lipstick? Why do we have jazz? Those were the questions for Renegade History. So it's like all the extraneous bullshit in the library was irrelevant. So I didn't even have to look at it. And I could go straight to the book, straight to the article, straight to the source every single time, either on Google or in the actual library. But you got to have the right question.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And there's never been a time where you find some essential fact just by complete chance, where you're flipping through the magazine at the waiting room and you just see something that, like, oh yeah, this completely fits. This is the next thing I'm looking at.
Yeah. I'd say like 5% of what's in my books I get from like some comment on someone I heard from someone, or flipping through a magazine or Twitter, or yeah, random stuff. Where it's kind of scary sometimes, where I'm like, you know, I'm doing something completely different, like making a dentist appointment or something, and I'll see something on my screen and be like, oh, I forgot to look at the Nationalist Party in Japan in the 1920s. Damn it, I gotta get back to that. But yeah, it's 95% of it is on my path, right? 5% is by chance, I'd say.
Yeah, I remember. I think Roger Long said like he figured what the first libertarian book he read was, but like might have been just being one of Ayn Rand's essays. But he's like, he read this book and then he read all the books mentioned in that book, and then all the books that authors that those books mentioned, and that there is this particular kind of nerdy personality that like there's a lot of libertarians like that, but it will never be a mass movement because there are people who are going to do that of just reading, you know, who will do that, reading all the books that are mentioned in, you know, one book they like, but
yeah. Libertarians are just like socialists. I've known, you know, I went from the socialist world to the libertarian. It's the same people, just different politics. So they're just intellectuals. They read books all the goddamn time, and they're basically mostly irrelevant in the world because of that.
Socialists kind of know that that's not how most people are, like that their politics gives lip service to the masses, but they say they're the vanguard. You know, actually, well, Rothbard actually explicitly modeled his libertarian strategy after the Leninists, actually. He said, like, libertarians need a vanguard as well, which he took from the hard left Marxists. But most of them were like, you know, why isn't every other person like a total, you know, dweebu, you know, reads 50 obscure books and parrots, you know, whatever obscure terminology. It's like, how is this, you know? Like even the Ron Paul people, like, so you know, there are more of them, but yeah, most of them are not like that.
Okay, so here's how I approach things, which is not entirely a virtue, and I wouldn't necessarily recommend this. This is just the way I'm built, okay? And none of you will be surprised to hear this. So when I have a project, like a book or an article, or I'm just making an argument, I'm in it to win it, you know? I'm not in it to explore ideas. Like once I've taken a position and I know what my position is, and I come across a person or a thing or a book that contradicts it and we engage, I'm there to win. So I am only interested in the evidence that is going to advance my argument. And I'm going to put as much of that in my work as possible. I am going to speak as clearly as possible because your language obscures your argument and makes it less effective. I am only here to win this argument. So that's why Renegade History is chock full of evidence and data, which actually that's the only complaint I ever get about that book is that there's too much evidence in it. When you take a radical position in particular, you've got to come super strong with the evidence, right? Your case has to be especially strong when you are the radical in the room, or when your book is taking a position against the status quo, right? Your argument has to be two or three or four times more powerful than the mainstream argument. Otherwise,
yeah, mainstream, it doesn't have to have evidence at all. It's everyone knows.
Right. It's like, right. Mm. It's like the air we breathe. And so otherwise you just get dismissed. I mean, you still get dismissed even if you come with a perfect argument. But you just get ignored. But you have to, the standards are always higher for radicals, no matter what kind of radical you are. As long as you're outside the mainstream, you have to do better than everybody else. It's just the fact. So for me, Landry, it's history is like a detective story or something. And I'm like unfortunately, I'm sort of like the prosecutor in that case where it's like, I'm just trying to convict this dude or get him off, whatever it is. I'm just trying to win the case. That's the way. And that's, you know, and then the creativity and the artistry and the writing, and that's secondary, but like, I need to persuade you that the United States made World War II into the killing field that it was, right? That's it. That's my only interest here. I need to get that into your head so it's like fill you with evidence and the argumentation as clearly as possible. So there we go.
Thank you.
Thank you. I love you guys. Thank you for doing this. It means everything to me. It's awesome. You're so fucking smart. I'm just proud as hell. Thanks. And we look out for University 2.0 coming out soon. Most or all of you will be probably participating in some way or another. In fact, do we even know? Like,
yeah, no. Everybody in here will be able to get into the beta test.
Right, but what do we think? Like when? Next week, maybe?
I don't know if I want to promise anybody, but I think we'll get it out before 2019 for sure.
Yeah, we're really close.
We're very close. We could do it today if we had to. I just don't want to.
Yeah, we just don't want Gord in there messing shit up yet. So, make sure everything's like streamlined before we allow that anarchist in there. But yeah, that'll be days or weeks. And I really look forward to you guys. I can't wait to hear what you have to say about it. And we don't want you to praise us. We actually want you to tell us what's wrong with it. We want you to find everything that's wrong with it. So we want you to be little nasty detectives. Seriously, that's the only thing that's going to be useful. From how it looks to how it operates, to how it functions, to we want different, better courses to fire the head instructor, to whatever it is you think. We want that. We want criticism, actually, not praise, but it'll be fun to hear from you. So look for that. And I'm going to do these more often because these are a blast. And a lot of you seem to show up for this and liked it. So I think we'll do more. Looking forward to it. Thanks again, guys.
All right, guys. If anybody, like I said at the beginning, if anybody wants anything cut out or whatever, for any reason, just email me, let me know, and we'll take it out. So thanks.
Right on.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Peace.
Bye.
Thank you.
This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To support the show and become a member of the Unregistered community, go to unregisteredunderground.com. To get information and to buy tickets to the Renegade University weekend events in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C.,
go to thaddeusrussell.com/courses. Thanks for listening.